right, this is the Sunstone Podcast, and I'm your host, John Larson. Welcome to another fantastic episode. We're here tonight with one of my personal heroes and a friend who has agreed to come on and help us out, Dr. Jeff Anderson. Jeff, welcome to my basement. We're actually in my basement tonight.
Such a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. Now, we're going to talk about some of the research you've been doing up at the U for a while and some of the things you're looking at in the future. But this last year, it's been 2 years since the big paper we're going to talk about here in a second.
That's right.
Since you achieved international notoriety, right?
Yeah, for better or worse.
Now, Jeff, you, first of all, you're a medical doctor.
I am.
Now, tell us about that.
Well, I trained actually... is with dual training. So I have a medical doctorate and I also got a PhD from Northwestern University in neuroscience.
Jeff is honestly one of the smartest people I know. You're also a published author. We have to bring this up right away, right? A best-selling author.
Yes.
What does it mean to be best-selling?
There's a lot of bestseller lists and some of them written by my mother.
I do have a copy of your book here that Brent, our friend Brent gave me, and I sorry to say I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I've written 3 novels and a couple textbooks.
Jeez. So you got your PhD in what was it again?
Neuroscience.
In neuroscience, and then your MD, and your specialty in medicine?
Radiology.
So you're up at the U right now, and you're a researcher.
That's right.
And you have been a professor. You're not teaching as much right now.
Yeah, well, I do teach residents and fellows every day. Part of my job is being in the reading room where we read MRI scans and CT scans for patients, looking at the brain and spine and other disorders. And then part of my time is doing experiments, trying to understand how the brain is put together and how things might go awry in disorders, especially autism, Down syndrome, Alzheimer's disease, other types of neurological disorders.
That sounds really tricky to do research on folks who have these sort of disorders.
It is. It is tricky, but there's a lot of smart people who've figured out a lot of the hard work. So really what my lab is focused on is what is the architecture of the brain? How is it put together? What regions perform which tasks? And why is that different in diseases that range from psychiatric conditions to developmental conditions? And a lot of what we do has to do with brain imaging. So I'm looking for new types of imaging tests that will help us diagnose Alzheimer's disease or autism. What is it that we can do that will really help patients and actually make a difference in the lives of people that may have conditions that need help?
Fantastic. I have, through my family members, been involved with the University of Utah and your research and the folks up there working on autism. And I very much appreciate all the fantastic folks you have up there. I know you're not in charge of all of them, but go ahead and take credit for it.
Oh, yeah. There's a great team. Some amazing, talented people.
For sure. Now, I hinted at that there was a lot of notoriety that came out just a little while ago. But first of all, let's talk about your connection to the church. You grew up in the Salt Lake LDS Church.
That's right.
And you went on a mission. Where'd you go on your mission?
I went to Holland in Belgium.
You've been back since, no?
A couple of times, yeah.
Was it a successful mission, would you say?
Yes, very much so.
Tell me, what made it successful for you?
Well, it was an experience that I thought at the time was particularly meaningful. I thought that, you know, what yardstick do you judge a mission by? Most people say it's how we change ourselves. And what I learned was that regardless of, you know, who you contact or what you do on your mission, a lot of those feelings that you get are things that stay with you regardless of which way your life goes afterwards.
It's an impactful time, and there are those of us who are fortunate to have experiences, I would say, in populations that aren't as receptive to the gospel, can we say? You know, if you're going to Mexico City, oftentimes those missionaries, at least when we were younger, they baptized tons of people. And, you know, my mission with, like, Laotian refugees, it was fraught. It was hard to reach those folks. And I'm sure... you know, in Europe where you were, is a little bit more difficult, which gave me a sense of introspection, thinking about my own faith, thinking about myself. And I found that to be a life-altering experience, mostly for the good.
Well, I was very devout. I spent the time on my mission, you know, doing missionary work. I was immersed in it, and I loved it. I was very much at home. I felt like I was doing something really meaningful.
How did that influence your decision to go into med school? I mean, that's a big decision.
I actually came about it kind of through the back door. So what I was really interested in college was studying mathematics. And that kind of led me to look at problems that were particularly challenging. And one of the most challenging problems I had was understanding information. What it means to be able to know what is true. I looked at philosophy and epistemology. I looked at ultimately our brains and how we understand whether something is meaningful or true or important. And the challenges in understanding how our brains function just enthralled me and captivated me. And that, it was really my life's goal, was to understand how the brain works, and especially about complex topics like high-level information, how we process attention and language, and how we feel love, how we do these things that make us human. And that led me into medicine, because I wanted to be able to ask some tough questions, and I thought that part of that means understanding everything I could about the brain and the body and how they work together.
It's interesting. You know, my undergraduate degree was in linguistics, so some of the same questions were really fascinating to me, like how our language is tied to the way we process the world, kind of the Sapir-Whorf sort of element. But I'll tell you honestly, the brain and studying the brain always spooked me, because I'm scared of the demon of total determinism. And because the brain is mechanical, basically, in my view, it was a little spooky for me as a believing young student to even go there.
Yeah, I think I was maybe just a little bit cocky when I started out that this wouldn't be a real issue, and maybe I didn't really understand the problem. You know, it's interesting that when we talk about the history of science and religion, that there has always been a conflict, which some people minimize and other people accentuate. But of all of the areas where you think of science and religion conflicting, like cosmology or perhaps when you think of what Galileo did, claiming that the Earth rotated around the sun, or talk about the theory of evolution, what really strikes me now is that neuroscience has always been the primary conflict, because nothing is more personal than your religious feelings and spiritual experiences and how those might relate to the brain. And I think most people to this day don't realize how deep and how absolutely devastating that conflict is between science and religion, specifically with relation to neuroscience.
I agree, you know, and I've said before that the real conflict between science and religion was all laid out, you know, 600 BC, 400 BC, you know, by the Greeks. Mm-hmm. And those questions are deep, and as you say, you know, devastating. It's a difficult reconciliation. So as you start, you know, med school as a believer, no?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So as you start delving into this further and on your path, how did it modify or how did your faith impact your study?
Well, that was evolving over time. I think when I finished graduate school and medical school, I was very much a believer. I had been in a couple of bishoprics in Chicago, and was looking forward to trying to harmonize spiritual feelings with what I was learning about the brain. And, you know, that's been a quest of mine for a long time.
And let me state, I believe personally, in my experience, that there's a lot of great scientists who are people of faith of all sorts. And I don't mean to imply in these questions that being an individual of faith would somehow impact your ability to do good science. And of course, you work with a lot of LDS colleagues today, no?
Absolutely. Incredibly talented and thoughtful colleagues.
So how has your faith journey, do you think, impacted your study? I know that's a big umbrella question to start with.
Well, when we talk about our study of religion in particular, I think our background absolutely shapes how we understand and see results. That's part of the reason why it was so important to us from the very beginning to have a really diverse study team. So our study team included people that were active LDS, people that were ex-LDS, people, a Jewish woman, people that had diverse views on religion and faith. And that was important. It keeps us honest. It helps us to really do good, rigorous science that is not jumping to any conclusions, but really just trying to understand the truth.
Do you think that being here with this active, very religious population, you know, in Utah, does that impact your ability to, or do you have more things open to you? Does that give you opportunities?
Yes and no. So the question of population and is really kind of a fascinating question, because it astonishes me that after decades of really high quality neuroscience, that yet there are only a handful of reports about understanding what is perhaps the most important aspect of our lives that determines our behavior. And those are these deeply held religious and spiritual views. And to me, I just am bewildered at how we have orders of magnitude more information about the sense of smell than we do about some of these core beliefs that shape how we see the world. And so when I started into this field interested in what can we do to use state-of-the-art brain imaging tools to understand religion and spirituality, I started looking into the literature, and it was just a jaw-dropping experience to see how sparse the information was. It's literally a handful of papers, most of which are underpowered, the methods of which are dated, and yet I understand why now, because it's really difficult to fund a research program in this area. And it's even more difficult to gain the trust of the people that you want to work with to really authentically study religion in some ecological, organic way.
Well, you say people you work with, I see two populations. You've got the powers that be who have to approve and fund research, and then you've got the folks that you're actually performing the research on. And you were implying that with the second group, your research studies.
That's right.
But it would seem to me that they both are impactful.
Yeah, that's true. It's a very different dance to talk about your research findings with very diverse groups, whether that be the people who participate in the research or the people who peer review or fund the research or are interested in a scientific perspective. Very different interests and often opposed.
Well, and I know this is a difficult question, but how does that play out at the University of Utah in particular? I mean, for the background, the U has always walked this line between a very secular kind of non-Mormon approach, and yet there's still sitting general authorities on the board of directors of the U. Bishop Burton comes to mind.
Well, I think I kind of sidestepped that question, because really for us, what our goal is to wake up in the morning and do the best science that we can, ask the most impactful questions. And if we are rigorous and we have a talented team that represents diverse viewpoints, I think we kind of just figured that those issues would take care of themselves if we do good science.
And I know we're jumping way ahead, but you did get a little bit of blowback from the church on this.
I did, yeah.
And the administration, they had your back.
The university did. There was some question. We can talk about the media response and the fallout from our study, but there was some question from state legislatures about, is this research attacking the church, which was certainly not our intention. And that issue came up, is should the legislature take action or punitive action against the university because a study was done at the University of Utah, and that ultimately didn't go anywhere. But it's eye-opening to note that these are issues that are important to people. They care about how religion is perceived and what it means. And we have to be cognizant that the types of studies we're doing affect people's lives, and we're, that's humbling.
It is, and I think for religious powers, people running churches, those sort of folks, it wasn't that long ago in the United States when they had a lot of deference given to them, that, you know, attacking the clergy directly was considered taboo.
That's right.
And those norms have shifted, but not completely. I'm empathetic to the leaders of religion as they try to navigate this world that is frankly becoming much more hostile to them in ways that they're not always well equipped institutionally, structurally to deal with. And they're oftentimes in a quandary, you know, of how to respond to these things, you know, especially, research like this that might be interpreted as being against what they're saying.
Yes. I think when you have a background coming from medicine or science, there's some things that are just not really controversial to you, partly because you have special knowledge in that area. And that's true regardless of which area that you're specialized in. If you have experience being a clergyman or experience being a teacher, I think that gives you special knowledge about certain perspectives. And when you're all of a sudden confronted with trying to understand information that's coming from a perspective that's very alien to you, I think that's discomforting.
Well, we've hinted at your research enough now that we've annoyed half the audience. So let's jump in. Well, maybe we start right at the title of your research.
So our project, when we started out, we wanted to set an ambitious goal for ourselves. And we called our project the Religious Brain Project, because our goal was to understand how religion and spirituality are perceived in the brain. And so when we started out, we spent a few years just talking about the possibilities. This was something that many of us were passionate about and had been for many years. And by the time we'd kind of finished recruiting our study team, there were five or six of us that were part of the core team representing fields from human genetics to imaging to neuroscience. And really, we had the serendipity of being in a place that had the perfect population to study. And it turns out that, unbeknownst to us from the beginning, that really Mormonism is probably the perfect group of individuals to study for this type of question.
Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. So, first of all, the most important thing when you're doing brain imaging is you have to capture in a laboratory something that is happening in the brain. And even more constricting in the environment of an MRI scanner, which can be hostile. It's loud, it's noisy, but it's also very private, and you can be secluded with your thoughts. But what we really needed was a population that could tell us, I'm feeling something right now. And to have somebody that has the confidence to say, this is a feeling that I recognize, this is important, this is spirituality to me, you need a charismatic religious practice, and especially one with shared training where people recognize similar types of feelings or experiences. And the resource of having such a large percentage of volunteers who had served missions where the main thing they did every day was to recognize, I'm feeling the spirit right now, and being able to acknowledge that, you know, for years at a time, especially in a young population that is healthy, doesn't have a lot of comorbid brain illnesses, where we can really see what we want to see without looking through the problems of other diseases. It was just an absolute blessing.
Let me strip that down. What we're saying is, with the Mormon population of returned missionaries, we have a population that believes they're talking to God, but they're not crazy.
That's right. That's right. And there is something very tangible where they say, I know when I'm feeling a spiritual experience. And as we started talking about our research, we held a town hall meeting. And, you know, when we do a study for autism or for Down syndrome, and we start to announce that we're going to do a new project, you know, it's crickets. Nobody cares. Nobody knows unless we find something interesting. But here we had immediate interest, and there was national media coverage within a day of us just announcing that we were going to do this study. We held a town hall meeting, and it was packed to the brim.
So why that move? I think most scientists don't necessarily hold town hall meetings when they're starting new research.
Well, it was important to us to have transparency, to let the community know what we were doing and why, and to get input, because we wanted buy-in from stakeholders.
What did you think might go wrong?
Well, misperceptions. People thinking that we're trying to attack religion or support religion. And we had people on both sides, you know, thinking that that's what we were after. And so communication is important.
Yeah, it would seem that you have the same problem that all those ghost hunters have. You know, they have like these magnetic whatever it is, these devices, and they're measuring heat spots and orbs. But no one's ever established scientifically that those things... How do you get out of that conundrum with religion, that there's those of us who would say... Well, I shouldn't say those of us. I'm not necessarily in that camp. There's people that say, there's no such thing as these experiences, so how can you measure them?
Well, it's even more complicated than that, because what we found as we started talking about what we wanted to do was that people would say, they would kind of smile and nod and say, yeah, you might understand that kind of experience, but what's really important is this kind of enlightenment. So whether we were talking to Buddhists who are saying that what you're studying is some kind of a hallmark spiritual experience, it's not like true spirituality. And then some evangelical Christian would say, well, what you're studying is, you know, the Mormon experience, which isn't really true enlightenment or spiritual knowledge. And that attitude was so pervasive that no matter who we talked to, people were really hesitant in pinning down that what we were studying was important. And a lot of the reasons why I think much of the research in spirituality before has focused on professionals, so like Carmelite nuns or Zen practitioners with tens of thousands of hours of meditative experience or other types of professionals, it was to sort of lend credence, like this is important because this person knows what they're talking about. But I think to us, it was really important to understand what happens to most of us as we have spiritual experience. What are the types of feelings that motivate the lives of billions of people? And I think in the Mormon community, we found a really good window for looking at types of spiritual experiences that really drive and motivate and are deeply important to people.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast, where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
So was your study population exclusively Mormons?
Yes.
And they were all believers. Well, let's talk about your population, how you selected them, mm-hmm. how many you had, what was going on there?
So we had, you know, through the regulatory process, we have an institutional review board that looks at our experimental design, and, you know, there's many iterations, and what ultimately we started with was, when we announced that we were doing the study, it turns out that we had kind of wall-to-wall media coverage for days, and we had hundreds of people contact us already saying they were interested in participating. In addition, we did a public relations campaign where we put out a website and flyers and asked people to contact our web-based screening, where they just answered a few questions about religious activity. And some of the study team were active LDS. I think we had some real deep expertise in understanding what kind of a study population we were looking for, which is somebody who was a returned LDS missionary, somebody who was devout. And so we asked about things like temple attendance, callings, scripture study, personal religious practice. And I think we were able to obtain a population that genuinely did reflect a devout, young, returned LDS missionary population.
So what did you use as your null case? Did you put a bunch of like masturbating atheists in there?
Well, actually, yes. but that came later. The study we were designing was to use each person as their own control, where we were looking at times when they were feeling spiritual experiences more strongly and less strongly, and comparing those two times to understand what was happening in the brain. So it wouldn't have been particularly helpful to have a control population in the classic sense. But as we did more of the research and started getting more media attention, there was a big feature study in the LA Times, and then we had a TV series that was produced from Al Jazeera when there was an Al Jazeera network in the US, and two of their reporters came to visit us. We also had the science reporter for the Los Angeles Times that came and watched one of our experiments. And some of them we put in the scanner. And like you might predict, it wasn't really helpful, because part of our experiment was identifying when somebody is feeling these spiritual feelings, and if they get nothing, then we see nothing. I mean, we there's nothing we can do with that.
Well, and growing up in the church, we were trained to identify the 1992 discussions, which we would have all used, literally had a point in there where it said, and that's the spirit that you're feeling right now. So we were all very much trained in it. So I'm assuming that your audience had been told exactly, this is a spiritual experience, this is not.
That's right. Well, there's common training, for sure. But we've done other experiments in other groups. For example, we've done experiments in Zen practitioners that we flew in from all over the world that also had a lot of common training, and sometimes two people that studied with the same master. When we were looking at where their brain goes during deep meditation, it was different. And in the responses to, especially in contemplative practice in Eastern spiritual traditions, the brain responses can be quite different to Western religious experience and maybe very idiosyncratic or variable. And we didn't see that as much with the Mormon population, which was really interesting to us.
You mean it was consistent?
That's right.
How much of that can be attributed to the fact that they're all from Sandy?
They weren't. We had people that had moved to the broader Salt Lake region from different countries in the world, people that had very diverse experience, that people had different ethnic and racial backgrounds. And there were a lot of different stories that, as we talked to them after, about how they came to their religious belief. Some of them were converts. Some of them were born in the church.
Okay, so we took these returned missionaries, both men and women, I'm assuming.
That's right.
And we rolled them into an MRI. And do they have some kind of spiritual meter so they can tell you how spiritual they're feeling at the time?
So we did a couple of things. One is that we had inside the MRI scan that we performed probably 7 or 8 different tasks that we had them do. That included some control tasks where they're just kind of sitting in there with their eyes open, but also video stimuli. Like one of our control video stimuli was watching the audit from General Conference.
Oh, the audit report.
That's right.
The number of new units and whatnot.
Yeah. We also had a period of personal prayer. We had two sessions where they were watching spiritually evocative videos. These were Mormon messages videos where the church had already done the heavy lifting and preparing material that was ideal for the population.
Those are kind of very short, like 2-minute
Yeah.
sort of spiritual uplifting thoughts.
Yeah, and we'd aggregated a few of those together for a longer experience. And then we'd also had scripture reading, some classic, you know, scriptures that all of them were intimately familiar with. And we also had quotations from world and religious leaders in the LDS church that were Christian themed, where they would, and then in each of those stimulus paradigms, they would describe what each quotation meant to them in terms of, are they feeling the Spirit, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, and how meaningful is the content of either the quotation or the scriptural passage. And so moment to moment during the scan, we were able to ask them questions that would rate how their feelings were rising or falling throughout the course of the MRI examination. And that especially was true during the video stimuli, where we had a button where they could press anytime they had a peak religious experience, or when they felt something particularly strong or meaningful, they would push a button and we'd have that recorded and time locked into.
How did you develop this population's trust as they're sitting in the MRI, they're watching these things? I can see some skepticism towards science and a scientific inquiry.
Well, I think you are honest with your participants. I mean, that what we really want to understand is what you feel. We have people that respect the research participants and deeply appreciate their contributions. And that's another thing that was kind of serendipitous about studying Mormons, is there's a culture in Salt Lake, and in Mormonism in particular, of participation with scientific research, a deep sense of cultural buy-in for volunteerism and helping to further science that I think dovetails with a lot of the history of the church in relation to science, that it was always a more harmonious relationship than has been in many other faith traditions.
I think you make a good point, and I want to emphasize it. You know, when I was at BYU, of course there were like religious professors and students who were in other colleges, especially non-scientific ones, who were very hostile towards science. But in all my experience at BYU, and I took every evolution class they had because I was trying to understand it, I found that the Mormons are actually quite good at bifurcated thinking about keeping religion in the religious realm and in their area of expertise, giving science its full shake. So I personally, when I see that there's a Mormon scientist who's, you know, let's say studying geology, I believe that they're doing good geology. I just don't believe that guy is necessarily going to have good thoughts on other areas of science.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you look at, you know, in virtually every field, there's someone at BYU who's doing world-class work in the field. And if you really look at the motivations, I think, from talking to our participants, is there's a lot of overlap in what they were looking for and what we were looking for. They also wanted to understand, what are these feelings that I have? What does it mean? What is happening in the brain? That's endless fascination. And as we went through the fallout of our study, a lot of people were interested, but nobody was more interested than the Mormon population themselves.
But let's dig into that more. What were they looking for? What motivated these guys to participate in your study?
Well, I think one of the media interviews we did, there was a really delightful research participant, and she helped with a number of media interviews, talking to reporters and explaining what her experience was. And I think she said, kind of summed it up best, that when we showed her the results after the study and say, this is kind of what we found, she thought, so it's real. So it in some way validated the sense that these feelings that they kind of knew were reproducible or meaningful or important, to have some external validation saying that the same thing was happening in their brain each time, I think was really meaningful to them. And the flip side of that was where the questions would talk to people about our research, and we'd get sometimes from an LDS audience is, what if other people feel this too? Like people from different faith traditions. And that was a little disturbing, I think.
So let's unpack what exactly was happening. So they're in there. They have a 0 to 5 spiritual meter. Mm-hmm. You're showing them these different things. And you see in the MRI scanning a correlation between what they're reporting and what's going on in their brain.
That's right. So what we found was really surprising to us because, you know, I've been doing this type of functional imaging research for a long time. And, you know, if you have somebody wiggle their finger, you know where you're going to see activity in the brain. It's really characteristic. I mean, these are stimulus response. The response doesn't vary. But when you start talking about more complex experiences, the literature isn't that reproducible. You know, there's you need large study sizes. You need, and people often find contradictory results. But what we found was that in four separate paradigms, completely different experiments, we found the exact same network of brain regions that was activated all four times. And that to us was, I mean, it's like we're doing a simple motor task. I mean, it's that robust where what we saw was highly reproducible. And
very consistent from person to person.
Yeah.
So what areas of the brain were lighting up?
So we should talk about them because there's some fascinating brain regions. So the one that really captured most people's attention and imagination was an area called the nucleus accumbens. So the nucleus accumbens is the reward center of the brain or the pleasure center of the brain. It's active when you have, in the literature, when people experience love or romantic bonding or parental bonding, when you win at gambling, with cocaine or methamphetamines, with a whole range of experiences that are pleasurable or rewarding. But that was only one. So there were half a dozen other regions that were part of this complex pattern. So another one is an area called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is involved in valuation or judgment. When you're trying to decide what is something worth to you, that region tends to be active. There were two regions in the brain, the anterior insula and the anterior cingulate cortex, that are part of the brain's salience network or novelty detection network. When a stimulus is unexpected or salient or important, these regions tend to be active. There was an area called the frontal eye field and the supplementary motor area, which are attentional regions. So these tend to be involved in focused attention. And then there was an area called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is involved in reasoning and analytical thought and pattern recognition. And all of these areas were active together. And probably the combination of these regions is what's the special sauce.
Now, you said you brought in some Zen practitioners, no?
That's right.
Now, my understanding in reading some of the other literature, sort of pop literature, you know, books like Why Buddhism is True, they talk about Zen masters tend to be able to, how would I say it, dim brain activity. Like they don't, they're not as active when they're really good. Did you see that sort of thing happen?
Well,
or was it the same as the LDS?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a misnomer because nobody really dims brain activity. The brain is always active. It's just a matter of which part. What we saw was that there were differences from individual to individual, even in the same tradition. So one group of individuals tended to have limbic activity. These are areas of kind of, you know, the more reptilian brain that are involved in emotion and kind of more fundamental types of feelings and responses. Another group of people, what we mainly saw was a decrease in language centers in activity. So they were shutting off the language regions of the brain. Another group, we saw attentional activation. So this was focused attention and not much else. So the pattern kind of differed, and there wasn't a consistent common pattern that we saw.
When I use the term flow, you understand what I'm talking about. And to kind of define that, it's something that people are trying to achieve all the time through all sorts of activities. Kind of when you're lost in the moment, you lose track of time, you're very much enjoying what's happening, the noise in your brain kind of diminishes. Am I describing flow correctly?
Yeah, for sure.
How much would you say this sort of activity correlates with sort of the brain activity you'd expect to see in flow?
I don't think we actually know what happens in flow states. That's something that I've talked to a lot of scientists about this, and nobody's really found a good paradigm for measuring that yet. Because
maybe you did.
Well, maybe. What we see in this religion network, I guess you could call it, or this pattern of brain regions we saw, is something that I think is important in a lot of areas of science, and that's the idea of emergence. So if you are a chemist, the types of things that you study, reactions between molecules, is constrained by physics and subatomic particles. But to try and understand chemistry from subatomic particles is virtually impossible. There's just too much complexity. And by the time that you try to do all the interactions, there's just a different flavor of how things behave in chemistry. And you need a chemist that's kind of trained in that level of analysis. And then to a biologist whose interactions in the tissues they study are shaped by chemistry, again, there's another level of complexity. And you really understand biology by studying biology, not by breaking it up into its parts and trying to understand the chemistry. I mean, the chemistry is helpful, but it doesn't explain the whole process, because at each level of analysis, there's a system that emerges that has its own behavior. And I think the same thing is true in the brain. When we talk about very simple responses that are just mediated in a single area of the brain, that's different. But when we start talking about interactions of 4, 5, 6 or more brain regions, then the feeling that emerges from those regions is different than just picking apart the individual components. But yet, each of those components adds to the feeling, and we can also, to some extent, use reductionism to understand, you know, why something feels the way it does, or how somebody might behave.
So these results became fairly predictable. Would you say that after you did this, you could look at a scan and say, yes, that person's, it appears that they're having the same sort of spiritual experience? I know that's a tough question.
That is a little hard to start to get to individual subject diagnostics. That's a challenge for us even now. But what we can do is we can look at individual differences. So, for example, these types of feelings differ a little bit from person to person, and sometimes the differences are more meaningful than the similarities. So we also had a whole battery of questionnaires and other types of tests that we gave our participants, and one of those was the Moral Foundations questionnaire. That's Jonathan Haidt's work. And what we found was that people who had a certain outlook in terms of their moral values had different brain regions that were active than others. So the insula, which is associated with empathy and social function, was more active in individuals that prioritized harm care domain of the Moral Foundations questionnaire, for example. So those kind of things we could see.
I wonder here, you know, I think about my own religious experience, and I believed strongly, but I had a hard time, in my words, which are probably not good words, manufacturing spiritual experience. I believed, but these experiences, like when I would be around a bunch of missionaries, all clearly in some kind of static religious experience, I had a trouble with that.
Yeah.
I've heard it argued before that, you know, the number of people who actually abandon religions is statistically very small. Maybe less than one standard deviation. Now, most people just stay with their religion. They never, they never challenge it. Could it be that I'm the defective one, that folks like me who leave religion, we can't manufacture those experiences? When I say manufacture, I mean things happening on an unconscious level.
Well, so one of the really interesting upshots of our findings was this involvement of the brain's reward network sort of recasts the whole experience in terms of classical conditioning. Because when you talk about anything that involves the reward network, whether it's, you know, responses to drugs or to gambling or other types of experiences that focus on this system, there's a lot of the same behavior that you see. And so really bringing spiritual experience into the realm of another type of experience that focuses on reward means that there's training involved. So how humans learn is through associative learning. We pair two things together, and then they begin to take on that meaning independently. So for example, what you could hypothesize is that if you have spiritual experiences that are focused on this feeling of reward, well, how you could induce that is you pair a spiritual dogma or an idea or a doctrine with some other pleasure-inducing experience. And that's what religious systems do constantly. So So music, for example, if every religious system in the world uses music as part of their liturgy, and so music is a natural reward inducer. There's been a number of great papers, one by Valerie Salimpour and Blood and Sator. These papers show that our brains naturally respond to music, and that it can be a pleasure inducer. So if you pair a doctrine with music, then all of a sudden the doctrine comes to take on that pleasure independently of the music. Now, the same thing happens with other types of pleasure-inducing experiences. And what often happens in religious traditions is that either something is banned, becomes a taboo, or it becomes co-opted and it becomes a sacrament. So take, for example, sex. So in most religious systems, there are deep and numerous taboos about sex, with whom it's permitted, under what conditions, what practices are allowed, all kinds of rules about sex. And to the extent that marriage or some types of relationships are favored, the religion very much plays a role in that. It's a minister that will marry you, or often the marriage relationship becomes a partnership with the church. And so either the church, you know, bans these other competitors that also activate the same brain response, this pleasure-inducing response, or it co-opts them and has that become a part of the religious experience, so that the religion essentially gets the benefit of that, those pleasureful feelings. Another example is drugs. So alcohol and drugs, banned by many religious systems. And when it's not, you know, you have examples like peyote or ayahuasca, where those drugs are part of the religious rituals, where they become effectively co-opted. And so you pair a religious doctrine with this pleasure-inducing chemical, and then independently that doctrine comes to produce reward.
So we're talking standard Pavlovian. You ring the bell and you give the food and you associate the bell with the food.
Yeah, it's really that simple, with the caveat that, you know, when you talk about the response to cocaine or to heroin, you know, it's immediate. You take the drug, you get the reward feeling. This is more complex. It's more like exercise or something. It's probably a good deal more healthy as well, right? Because these are complex reward responses. Like you might feel hiking in nature or seeing the earth from space. You know, these types of classical responses that just let people feel chills. That's the kind of response that we're talking about here.
But I've seen these same things argued that they create altered states of consciousness, right? Drinking wine, spinning around in a circle, chanting in a group, they make you receptive to, and like you say, religions either co-opt them or they ban them, because these things can induce these sort of spiritual experiences. Are we saying the same thing, or am I in a different parallel path?
Well, I think if you were looking at it from the standpoint of designing your own religion, well, if people are already able to have meaningful, pleasureful experiences outside of your religion, that makes it really hard to motivate allegiance and participation. And so it helps to have the main inducers of that pleasure network, whether it's music or family, social bonding. It helps to have those within the confines of your religious system. And what I think that spiritual results that we see in the scanner are telling us are that these responses are such that a scriptural passage or a quotation or an idea about the religion independently elicits reward. And how that came to be, you know, you could believe one of two things. You could say, well, either that is a manifestation of the grace and power of God touching the spirit through some means that is beyond our understanding of matter and energy, or that it is a conditioned response. And you know, they're both hypotheses.
Well, you tested for this a little bit. You implied earlier that you gave them not only quotes and things from the LDS Church, you threw in a smattering of things that weren't LDS.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. One thing we looked at was the timing of the responses. So during the video stimuli, for example, when they were pressing the button, we could actually see the timing of when things were activated specifically. And we found that that reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, activated precisely 1 to 3 seconds before they pushed the button. So there was a spike in activity in that region. You know, a couple seconds later, they pushed the button. So it was time-locked, where clearly part of what they were seeing as a peak response had an awful lot to do with what happened in the nucleus accumbens at that time. Now, another thing we did was we looked at some bigger questions about authority and how individuals responded to doctrines presented by church leaders. So in one of the experiments we did, we had quotations that were from one of six individuals. Three of them were LDS apostles, and three of them were world religious leaders, which were Pope Francis, Billy Graham, and Desmond Tutu. And so we showed them these quotations, and then after each quotation, which was a Christian-themed quotation, we would have them rate how meaningful is the quotation, the content of the quotation, and how much am I feeling the Spirit. And as you might expect, when we calculated the statistical responses after the experiment, when it was an LDS authority that was the quotation was from, there was an enormous increase in how meaningful the quotation was and how much they were feeling the Spirit. So much so that, you know, we were getting p-values of like 10 to the minus 10. I mean, it was crazy strong effect. And yet, because, you know, we really wanted to measure this systematically, actually all of the quotations were from C.S. Lewis, and we randomly assigned them to one of the six religious leaders.
So every quote that you gave them in the MRI was a C.S. Lewis quote.
That's right.
Because C.S. Lewis was in mind, because I was going to ask about, you know, I think that your average LDS person who's been to seminary would be able to tell the difference between standard Christian Protestant theology and Mormon theology. But C.S. Lewis is used so often in Mormon theology. Okay, yeah. So let's make sure this is a key point here. Everything that you showed them was C.S. Lewis.
Every quotation, you know, we showed them a total of, I think, 48 quotations.
And they had no idea.
No, they were not aware that we
did anybody pick up on it?
No, not that they at least told us about. And the statistics kind of speak for themselves. I mean, there was a clear difference, but it was unconscious. We had the quotation, then we had a little photograph of the source, and then an attribution like Pope Francis or Desmond Tutu, but what was really our objective was to look at, well, what's going on in their brain when it's one of the in-group leaders as opposed to an out-group leader.
When it was one of the supposed in-group leaders, because I want to make sure I'm understanding completely clear. You would show them, you know, it would say, blah, 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 you know, Russell M. Nielsen, and have his picture, but it was a C.S. Lewis quote.
That's right.
And you're saying that when it was identified as an LDS leader, they had a higher emotional, spiritual response.
And they said they were feeling the Spirit more, and they thought the quotation was more meaningful. Yeah. So then the question is, well, what's happening in their brain when we are processing messages from our in-group compared to an out-group leader? Because this isn't just about Mormonism. You know, if you'd taken a bunch of atheists and showed them quotes from Richard Dawkins and quotes from, you know, somebody less in-group to them, you'd see exactly the same thing. I'm confident about it. You know, regardless of which spiritual tradition you choose or which group of people, we respond differently to messages from people in our in-group.
Well, we've seen this effect basically happen with Trump supporters. It's been pointed out that Trump has not been consistent. He sometimes reversed his position, and his followers stay in stride. And your research would give a hypothesis to explain that.
Yeah, I don't see a difference between religion and politics.
You and I are on the same
page. Responses.
Religion, politics, and nationalism, they're all the same thing.
Well, so what this really drove this home to me is during the course of us doing this study, one of our kids was in a school choir, and we went to the Veterans Day concert. And, you know, having been immersed in this whole topic for some time, it was just amazing to me how much the rhetoric, the feeling, the types of experiences, the strategies that were used in a in a nationalistic, patriotic ceremony, how much overlap there is with a religious service. Yeah, very much the same.
Yeah, I recommend to everyone to read the book True Believer by whatever his name is, really delves into pulling this apart, how basically nationalism and religion function the same for mass movements.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that.
So how did they respond? I'm sure you let them know that these were all C.S. Lewis quotes.
No, we didn't.
They never knew unless they read the research.
Didn't. That's right. We went back and forth on that. We talked to our institutional review board about it, and you know, we were worried about the integrity of the research if we were to tell people, because you know, some of these people might have known each other. We didn't want to risk the chance that you know we would have a variable that we couldn't control. But I mean, we certainly didn't say otherwise. We just didn't disclose that.
What was the general take afterwards? Did they describe it as a spiritual experience? Did they?
They, to our surprise, every single individual that we tested said this was a meaningful spiritual experience on par with what they have in a intense worship service or personal spiritual practice. We had them draw diagrams of where their spirituality was through the course of the MRI scan after the fact. And what we found was that it kind of averaged about 2/3 to 3/4 of peak all-time spiritual experiences is kind of a general scale. And the words they used to describe it were peace, burning inside, classic vocabulary of an LDS spiritual response.
Well, you inadvertently, maybe it was on purpose. If you think about it, you're reproducing what many people go through in a religious experience.
That's right. That's oftentimes how we designed it.
Remove your shoes, then you go into the antechamber, and then there's an experience of the mundane versus the spiritual. And separating those. Almost every religion does that, and you are mimicking the same thing.
That's right. Yeah, unintentional.
It was intentional.
Yeah, I mean, we thought about... See, that's the advantage of coming from a tradition that you know well, because if you study religion, you have to do ecological experiments. You have to be able to fit within a specific tradition, and you can't have a general... There's no such thing as a general spiritual experience. They're very specific to someone's training and background.
Now, each of these individuals went through one of these, or did they do it multiple times?
We had a couple repetitions of some of the tasks, but it was a single MRI scan of about a little over an hour.
An hour they were in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from your perspective, what were the most interesting takeaways from the research?
Well, so one thing that I should mention is when we showed these quotations, as well as the video stimuli, we learned a little bit about what types of things are spiritual experiences. So, for example, we found that we could reverse engineer the Mormon Messages videos and think, well, second by second, we can identify the peaks. Like, this is a spiritual point in the video, this is another spiritual point. And when we did that, we found that a couple of types of brain patterns responded. One was when there were faces, that tended to increase spirituality. Another one was when the volume swelled, we'd have more button pressing.
The loudness.
Yeah, the loudness. So that was an indicator of something was more spiritual. Now, I mean, it's not independent because, typically... So actually, the people that produce these types of videos, like Bonneville Communications or other, video affiliations with the church, they actually have a patent on technology called Heart Cell.
Yes.
That is how to do this sort of thing. I mean, that's why I say they really did the heavy lifting for
and
us.
I think if folks want to go back into the old Mormon Expression archives, we did a whole episode years ago on Heart Cell. Yes.
Yeah. So what we found was people testifying, like, I testify, I know, I believe, those types of experiences would get button presses. Pictures of the suffering of Jesus or of children would get button presses. Faces in general, increased volume. So we could kind of predict, looking at the videos, where the hotspots were going to be. And then when we looked at the quotations, like when somebody was seeing a message they thought was from their own leader, really interesting pattern of brain activity there. So when somebody was looking at a quotation that was not from one of their authorities, there was activation in two areas, the fusiform face area and the amygdala. So the fusiform face area is an area of the brain that, processes attention to faces. It's very specific. It's over evolution. We've got our own brain region that just processes seeing a face and understanding this is a face. And the amygdala is an area of the brain that, is associated with fear, emotion, alarm, salience, alertness. And so we see them scrutinizing the photos more of the outgroup authorities when they were reading the quotations. And there was this amygdala activity. And then we saw one other thing. There was increased activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So this is an area that processes reasoning, analysis, logic. So that area was engaged more for the outgroup authorities than for the in-group authorities. So we're kind of looking at this and saying, well, they're giving a pass to the content of the in-group authorities relative to the out-group authorities.
You mean they're not challenging it? They're not...
Well, they're not analyzing it in the way that they are with the out-group. So there's this sense of heightened attention or alertness or
vigilance.
Alarm, vigilance, and also scrutiny of the content of the message more when it's an out-group authority message.
So they spend more time trying to process it, trying to contextualize it.
Yeah.
Fascinating. What do you think? I know this is pure conjecture. I come back to the idea of conversion. What do you think this means for conversion? Because we talk about that these things are trained and they're triggered, both what I'm taking away is culturally. I think you could find somebody who grew up completely secular in the United States that's been to the cinema is going to react to music and increased volume and certain tonal cadence.
Yeah. Well, you know, the conditions, I think, have to be right. So if you take a series of religious doctrines and you find a way to systematically pair those with pleasure-inducing experiences, then you have the ability to sit down with someone, and when they feel something meaningful, you say, that's the spirit. Well, that's how these types of associations can be made. And no, whether you're a believer or not a believer, I mean, that's the process by which we learn spirituality.
Right.
I mean, when you're a child, that's your experiences. Little by little, you learn to recognize feelings, and they become to be more strongly associated between religious ideals and the love of a parent or the support of a teacher or other types of things that are intrinsically rewarding.
Well, I'm not saying that LDS missionaries do this, but a common technique that's deployed by cults when they're trying to convert somebody is to fatigue them, is to overwhelm them, keep them away from sleep, isolate them. Mm-hmm. Given that, how do you think that, what is your research comment about that sort of practice?
Well, it's one of the questions that was really interesting to us is a Lutheran woman in Duluth reading her Bible feeling the same thing that, a Mormon missionary might feel giving a discussion as to what a religious extremist might feel contemplating religiously motivated violence? To what extent are these types of experiences canonical, or is it the same feeling in the same place in the brain, activating the same circuits that feels, to some sense, indistinguishable between these different cultures or faith traditions? Now, obviously, we don't have the answer to that. We've done one study in a single population, but the types of regions we're seeing, I mean, these are archetypal regions. There's just not that many regions of the brain that process reward. There's basically one, with modulators in different circuits. And what we're seeing is that these types of charismatic religious experience, I would be very surprised if it wasn't very similar between faith traditions, just given that the vehicle, the mechanism in the brain is so prototypical of attention or focused attention, reward, valuation, salience. Systems that are key parts of any ineffable spiritual or religious experience.
So this might be a good transition. Obviously, I mean, there's a lot of questions that have been surfaced through this research and a lot of ways that, I mean, I can imagine just sitting here, of places to take it. Where do you want to go next? What's next?
Well, one of the things that we're still kind of chasing down is looking at some of the genetics. So we our study's a little too small to do large scale, you know, genetic association studies, but we can look at things like the oxytocin receptor. And we've actually found that we measured through a blood draw before and after the scan oxytocin levels and found that spiritual activity in key regions of the brain that are implicated in oxytocin processing was associated with how much activity there were in those regions when they were feeling the spirit. So the oxytocin level predicted the spiritual response. And
is there like a basal rate of that you can go and measure?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated area and there's a lot of technical factors there, but it seems that it's not just dopamine that's involved. I mean, this probably also engages the serotonin system, the oxytocin system. There are genetic differences that almost certainly influence how susceptible you are to spiritual experience and ideation. And we'd like to understand more about some of those things. One of our colleagues, Julie Korenberg, is a very talented geneticist, and her team's been looking at that.
Well, you know, as we're sitting and talking about the research, I wrote the note of using this for evil. It seems like maybe you put a blueprint for somebody who wants to manufacture religious experience.
I don't think it's that much of a secret, honestly.
People already know this stuff, how to do it, right? Yes.
Yeah, I think better to shine a light on exactly what spirituality really means, because it affects people. You know, it's important.
Well, I'd be fascinated to see what these things look like, not just, as you say, you know, like, you know, not just evangelicals or, you know, the those who speak in tongues and these other ecstatic religious experiences. I'd be fascinated, but also chemically, like how does this compare to the brain on opioids, the brain on THC?
So addiction's on everyone's mind right now. You know, we don't really talk about religious experience in the language of addiction, but that's despite the fact that the same brain circuits are engaged. If we talk about falling in love, we don't speak of that as an addiction, but yet you have withdrawals when you're removed from the object of your affection. You have same types of neurophysiological responses that you have to drugs or gambling when you fall in love or when you become spiritually moved. And so a lot of the language is really more about, is it adaptive in our lives rather than is it the same type of experience?
Well, in my experience, you know, take like cannabis users. There are casual cannabis users, but you find the people who are really serious, like daily users, and they speak of cannabis with the same rushed tones that religious people talk about their religion.
Sure.
And I would think that some of the same experiences are somehow being manufactured, at least potentially.
Yeah, no, the differences are important here too, because again, when you have a drug that you're taking, it's a very predictable, consistent response that is carefully timed to when you take the drug. And so that's different for exercise, for spirituality, for things that are a little bit less stimulus response and maybe more complex. And it also lessens the addictive nature. And that doesn't mean that there isn't any. I mean, there's a whole side of religious experience where people have dysphoric experiences, where they are racked with guilt, where they have some kind of, you know, when we had our town hall meeting, one of the questions that moved me more than any other was somebody asking, are you going to study what happens when religion ceases to be a good thing in someone's life and when it starts to really, you know, be dysfunctional?
Like if we put, you know, an ex-Mormon in their angry phase and the same MRI from the same things, the response might be...
Very different, sure.
Well, it would be very different for sure.
Yeah.
And that's utterly fascinating to me. So in terms of formal studies, do you have anything queued up that you're going to next or that you're willing to talk about?
Well, we don't. We're still analyzing some of the data from our main study. And, you know, a lot of that is life happens, and most of our lab is focused on trying to figure out autism right now. But it would be fascinating to get back into this field because I think that it's really sorely needed. And I think our study, I hope, will serve as a blueprint for how you can use cutting-edge tools like the latest in MRI technology to understand something complex like religion. Because there's a lot of possibility for people to do follow-up studies, and the traditional challenge has just been finding some way to fund the research, you know, for good reasons. The NIH is focused on human health and disease, and the National Science Foundation doesn't tend to have a footprint there. I mean, the only real organization I know of that funds research into this type of questions are like the Templeton Foundation, which comes at it with a very clear agenda, and you know it's problematic.
The research is absolutely fascinating. We could spend another hour like picking this apart, but I do want to talk a little bit more about the fallout, the ramifications after this came out.
Yeah.
Because I remember when you released the study, it was immediate. That it was all over the national press.
Yeah,
and the international press.
Like a week, I think we were, you know, on the cover of all kinds of national newspapers in 20, 30 different countries, as well as The Onion. you know, I think at one point Miley Cyrus was talking about the study on Good Morning America. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Why? Why do you think it had so many legs?
Well, so Mormonism is fascinating to people.
Endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think also that they're just... is a hunger for knowledge about what spirituality means.
Well, I think we're in this sort of semi-post-religious secular environment in the United States, and because we were always more homegrown religion than our, you know, like say Japan or much of Europe, it has more of a root with us in a way, and in ways that we don't necessarily have contextualized, because American religious experience was very much about the I experience, about what Mormons have come to, you know, to embrace, that, you know, you need to have a personal conversion experience, which of course the evangelicals do, which is not a component of European Christianity at all.
Well, certainly not of, you know, contemplative
or traditional. Yeah. So I wonder if there's that element of just us trying to contextualize and understand what it even means to be religious in America.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that people love hearing about something that is about them, whether it's a personality test or some little tidbit of information that brings to bear on the thoughts that they have, but maybe haven't even shared with people or haven't understood. And so to see a window in, well, what is the brain doing when I'm feeling these feelings that I can't really talk about at work? And when I talk about it at church, it's in a different context. So, you know, that speaks to people because it's understudied. We just haven't explored what it means outside of our own religious systems. And yet we have people that are blowing themselves up in public markets or are building enormous cathedrals or writing symphonies motivated by these ideals. And we don't understand why.
That's fascinating. What's the church's response? We hinted a little bit, but after it hit, what did you see?
The church hasn't had an official response that I'm aware of. I think they've been mostly supportive. I think from individual members of the church, people were fascinated by the study and had a lot of different opinions on it, every side. There were some that were, you know, very upset. I mean, there was immediate tabloid coverage in addition to mainstream press, like saying that Mormon religion is nothing different than drug, sex, and rock and roll.
No, it's very different. I'm here to tell you they're not the same.
so some people saw it as that this was science attacking the church. Other people had more nuanced responses where they thought, well, you know, this is interesting. Because it sheds a light on what might be happening in the brain when I'm feeling something spiritual, and that's more of a curiosity. Other people, you know, said it's real.
It's interesting. It. I see the research almost as a Rorschach test, because to me, when I look at your research, it confirms in my mind my biases, which I believe spiritual experiences are real in that people experience them, but I don't believe they have a source outside of our own minds. Mm-hmm. That's that, and I see that in your research, especially with the C.S. Lewis stuff. But I can see how somebody who's a believer could look at the research and not take away that conclusion and not even be offended by the research.
Yeah, right. I mean, ultimately, there's nothing that we've done that if somebody believes these feelings, these special feelings that I have are there by the grace and power of God, that they're supernatural, they are mystical, and it is God talking to me in my heart, and I know it because I feel it, and I can't say anything else about it. There's nothing I can say that could dissuade them from that, because science isn't the domain of supernatural experience.
In other words, they would say, and I don't mean to put words in believers' mouths, but they would say, yes, this is just the mechanism that God uses to communicate with
Absolutely.
Us. Just like we have prophets,
right.
And they're a flawed mechanism. This is how God touches my emotions, and it's a flawed mechanism.
Yeah.
Well, what's your response to that?
I think that you can believe that there's a supernatural explanation for your experiences, but there's an alternate hypothesis that this is a neurophysiologic response that can be trained, that obeys all the rules we've seen of neurobiology and other contexts, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's the kind of response you would expect to see. And if that neurophysiologic response is present, well, then it just asks the question, do you need an alternate hypothesis? And that's kind of the case in many areas of science where originally there was an all-powerful creator that explained everything about the world, and the need for an alternative supernatural explanation beyond what we know from science or naturalistic reasons has gotten smaller and smaller, and that God of the gaps has become more about personal types of experiences. And so maybe this is one more area where some of the naturalistic explanations we have may compete for airtime against those supernatural explanations.
Jeff, this has been fascinating, and I really personally want to thank you for taking an approach to, you know, questions of religion without being dismissive of it. I think that's the brilliance of this study, is that you and your team clearly took religious experience seriously and handled it with respect, in my view. So,
well, thank you. That's certainly our intention.
And that's a very difficult thing to do. It's very hard.
But it should have respect, because religious feelings are what drive people. It's why they get up in the morning. It's why they live their lives and marry and have children and do great things in the world, because that's what motivates and drives them. And we have to recognize that regardless of the differences that we have, and when our gods may say different things to us as far as our doctrines and messages, it doesn't change the fact that maybe the messages from our gods are felt the same way in the same places in the brain. And that's a pathway for empathy and understanding and cross-cultural dialogue.
I agree. You know, I think years ago, of course, my approach was more sort of proof texting the church not to be true, because I saw a lot of the practices and things coming out were harmful. And now I see Mormonism and other religions as just a part of the human experience. And it's just a different approach. Yeah. And it's sometimes hard for the two sides to come together and try to speak a common language. And again, thank you for helping to bridge that gap.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Jeff, I appreciate it. And thanks to all you out there, including my little studio audience here. Oh, and any other last?
Yeah, I just can't emphasize enough the courage and the importance of what our study population, our volunteers, did. They did something that was uncomfortable, examining their own lives and feelings, and I have to give all credit to them for making possible this little incremental understanding of spiritual experience, and also thank a dedicated study team. So right from the very beginning, Jared Nielsen and Michael Ferguson were key in designing the outline of the research and seeing it from start to finish. Jace King, Julie Korenberg, Lee Dye, all of these were were incredibly talented scientists who made it all possible.
Jeff, thank you so much.